frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
I drink your milkshake.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Cineflec. I am your host, Ethan Colburn. I have a really fun one today. I had a great time talking with Griffin on this one. I'd never seen Live and Die in LA before. Really fun movie, super 80s, super moody. Highly recommend checking that out before you listen to this podcast. As always, there's spoilers in this episode, major spoilers throughout. We just dive into the whole plot. I think that goes without saying at this point, but just going to throw that out there in case I haven't like officially said that in a while. We always spoil things, so just watch out for that. It's intended for people who've seen the movie. But we drank whiskey and Cokes with this episode just because I felt like it was like a really... feels really grimy and like something you'd order in any dive bar. Any bartender knows how to make it. So wanted to do something basic and crowd pleasing. So that was kind of the concept there. In terms of episodes in the works, I am hopefully recording a Django episode soon. It's kind of crazy to me. I've only done one Tarantino movie, actually. I did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a while back, but be good to get through some more Tarantinos because he's a classic and he's going to retire soon and made lots of good movies, that guy. It's not exactly a hot take. Anyway... without further ado, I will throw you in this week's episode. I hope you enjoy.
Griffin, it's good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
I think the last time we recorded a podcast was the Lost podcast we recorded.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I was so bummed about because I remember it being pretty good. I didn't get a chance to ever listen back. What happened was we recorded a Sweet Smell of Success
Sweet Smell
podcast.
Of Success. Yeah.
On my work account, because my work account had like free Zoom, or I guess it was Teams, and then I got laid off. So I lost access and I forgot. I didn't really think in that moment to go and retrieve the podcast that I had not yet edited or published. So my mistake. It was a good time.
If you subscribe to the highest level of Patreon, that's a $500 a month tier, we will personally recreate it for you.
Live.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. How are you doing?
I'm doing super good. It's about 93 degrees here in Seattle. We don't have AC, so I'm just like burning up, sweating up a storm, and just watched To Live and Die in LA. So I feel like it's a pretty perfect fit.
I feel like Seattle has a thing with like pretending that they don't get extreme swings in weather, where like in the winter every year there's like snow, they pretend like it's the first time there's ever been snow, and then every year in the summer when it's like 90 something they pretend like they don't need AC because it's usually not 90 something, but it happens every single year.
It's only for like a few days, like less than a week for both snow and like extreme heat, but
it
I feel
is.
Like it just like it's long enough in between where it just like gets collectively wiped from everyone's memory here.
Yeah, people just forget about it.
Yeah,
I guess that's the problem. Yeah, I remember that in Seattle, like everything shuts down when it snows.
Yeah, like last year we had the super bad ice storm, and so there were like a record amount of like car accidents in like a 3-day span.
That was crazy. Dad, do you see like the videos of like the buses just sliding down the hill and shit?
I lived them.
that was wild. What a weird place. What a weird location.
Yeah.
That you've chosen to have as your home. Anyway,
I was born here.
Yeah, I guess so. LA.
Yeah, it's very different.
Very different. Have you spent much time in LA?
Oh, I've spent plenty of time in the airport.
Yeah, that'll do that. There are some airport scenes in this. Is that LAX? I think so.
I don't know. I've only been there a few times. Definitively, no, that is not the LAX airport in 1985. I know that for a fact.
Do you?
No.
Live and die in LA. We're drinking Jack and Cokes. You found a Jack and Coke. Was it like a pre-contained Jack and Coke in a can?
Yeah, it was
What's the
one of
story with
those
this?
shitty ones where, like, I've never had them, but the previous tenant in our apartment left one in the fridge because when we moved in, we were subleasing from him, so he wasn't ready at all. So we basically moved and packed all the shit out, and he just left so much behind. But on the bright side, I've had a Jack and Coke in the fridge for about a month now. It's just been sitting there, and I finally found an excuse to drink it.
And it's a Jack Daniels and Coke in the same can. So like they've collabed on this thing.
Yeah, it's a collab, yes.
It's a collab. It's a collab. Just like this podcast, it's a collab.
Yeah. Are you I think I was gonna ask who the Jack Daniels was, but I think I know that's you.
What?
Was gonna ask which one was Jack Daniels and which one was Coke, but I think I might be Coca-Cola and I think you might be Jack.
No, I feel like you're Jack. You had the spice. You add the spice to the podcast. I'm just the base.
You're just the most popular drink in the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. No, I'm not sure. Honestly. We can make analogies for the rest of the podcast. So I did not have Jack Daniels on hand. I had Jim Beam, which I almost feel like is more dive bar appropriate. I think the concept with this drink was like, let's do something that's very divey. This movie's very like scummy,
Yeah.
underbelly LA, kind of dirty. And I'm like, it has to be a simple drink. It has to be something that any bartender could throw together. Nothing fancy, no garnishes. I feel like Jim Beam was very appropriate.
There's multiple scenes of William Peterson drinking Jack Daniels straight from the bottle too.
Yeah, it's pretty great. It's pretty great. So we talked a little bit about before we started this podcast about how you haven't seen the big hits of Friedkin. You've not
Sure,
seen
yeah.
Exorcist and French Connection.
Okay, yeah, embarrass me in front of
Yeah,
like a bunch of people, thank you.
in front of dozens of fans.
But Ethan hasn't seen Sorcerer, which is also just a straight ripper, or Cruising, which
How
is
dare
so
you?
underrated.
How dare you? I'm banning you from the rest of the podcast. So what was your first experience with this movie, and how did you come into contact with it?
So I saw this last year. I saw it in theaters at one of the local indies in Seattle, and
That's awesome.
it played on a double bill with Michael Mann's Manhunter. It was a William Peterson double feature. And so
Oh,
this movie
I
played
forgot he's in
first.
Manhunter. That
Oh
that's where
God.
I'd seen him.
He's just like insanely good for two movies, and that's it. But both of these movies just played so well, and they're so coked out. And William Peterson's eyes are just bugging out of his head for both movies. And it was like the orange of To Live and Die in LA and like the Michael Mann blue of Manhunter. Oh, it's just so good.
Honestly, like the neon of the 80s is like something I really miss. There's like those there's like a few De Palma movies that have that as well, that kind of like very neon kind of grimy look to them, where they're it's a lot of like sunsets and like street lights and just weird times of day. These kind of liminal spaces, I feel like feel so like quintessentially of that era for me.
It's something that Michael Mann does so well, and
Yeah,
it's
for sure.
like Manhunter was one that I had seen before going into this theater experience. And I knew I loved it, and it was the one that was playing second, but I hadn't seen a single Friedkin movie or anything, so I was going into it completely blind, and it just like knocked my socks off. And so I've since gone back to a multiple times. And Kino Lorber just put out the 4K, so that was the one I watched tonight, and it just looks gorgeous. And there's just like an energy to this movie that cannot be replicated.
What about this movie do you feel like works so well for you? Like, what jumps out to you like immediately in watching it?
I think it's just like this grimy and scummy and blood soaked like tone to this movie that's paired with this like gorgeous like Robbie Mueller cinematography that has this neon, has these like dark burnt oranges, and it just paired with this like insane soundtrack that's entirely composed by Wang Chung, and then just these three things going together or like fighting for like your attention, your admiration. They're just trying to like one up each other at all times.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I feel like, okay, I don't know how to comment on this because you haven't seen French Connection. apparent film lover. I don't get it, but it's fine. This movie feels like a sequel to The French Connection in some ways. Like, I won't get too far into the plot of that, but also kind of like anti-hero detective and stuff. Like, very much focused on like the detective and his partner, or like the cop and his partner. And then in the way that movie dives so deep into like the feelings of like 1970 New York, this movie feels like it dives like straight into 1985 LA. But it's like in both cases, I kept sort of asking myself, like, does Friedkin care about the plot in this? And I don't mean this in the way that the plot's not interesting, but I mean this in the way that like it's almost like the plot's happening, but like he is so like hyper focused the whole time on setting the tone of every single scene that you're entering and creating ambiance. It almost seems like I really don't know how to like put it to words other than that it doesn't seem like he is as interested in the dialogue as the tone, even though the dialogue is captivating its own way.
Yeah, it's this interesting kind of thing where it plays like all the same cliches and tropes as so many different movies, but it never feels derivative of those movies. It feels like entirely its own entity, where it's so easy for a movie like this to fall victim to scenes that would make you eye roll or anything like that. But no, it just completely draws you in and gives you something that you've never been served before.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure. It's very like erotic and electric. We were talking about how erotic Willem Dafoe is in this.
This is the hottest he's ever looked in a movie.
I think so.
Either The Lighthouse.
That too. I was going to say Last Temptation of Christ, but maybe that's its own vibe. He's very captivating in this. He might be like my hair inspiration.
It really is. He's like always has this kind of like shimmer to him too, and he's like he is just shot like so elusively, and his eyes are just like so piercing, and he's always like showing like a little too much skin too, but he looks like a sculpture.
He does, and he still has it's sort of weird to see him as like a young guy. I think I texted you that. It's weird to see him like I just picture him as like this like older character actor, but he's very like, I don't know. He's very electric, and he has this like kind of old soul nature to him. But he's got to be like our age, I think.
He's got to be young. He just like hasn't quite grown. It's almost as if he hasn't grown into his like personality, or his aura almost.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure.
Where he has the looks that could be like he's like almost quite like leading man, but like. He's so hard to place into a movie because he's just like this weird specimen. But I feel like this movie just uses him so well.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. No, he's sort of like disturbingly like in power most of the time, but then he's constantly being shown to be like the smaller man in a lot of like the physical conflicts. So it's almost like he has this weakness, and he's got this like oddly feminine quality to him, like throughout a lot of the dialogue, but he's not, but yet he holds his power until he doesn't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, he's this like weird enigma where he's this like great artist, but he burns all his work, and he's like, he could easily make like enough money, if not more money, selling his art than counterfeiting, but yet he wants to do that. And I think Friedkin plays with his physicality so well, in that his kind of love interest pairing is someone who, it's a very tall woman compared to him. And there's even a scene where it, like, he goes in and like kisses her when she's in like a wig and makeup, and at first she looks like a dude, and you're like, is Willem Dafoe just tongue this guy? But like, no, she takes the wig off, but it's totally believable because he's just like this symbol of sex in this movie.
Definitely, definitely. How did you feel about like the counterfeiting plotline? I think I texted you this because I was watching him like create the $20 bills, and I was like, gosh, this looks like so much work for $80. And then he like, of course, he like, keeps it going. Like he just prints a bunch. Just small nitpick. I didn't feel like the bills looked that good. How did you feel?
Well, I think at one point he's shown throwing everything into like his dryer with a bunch of like poker chips and everything to kind of rough them up. So I don't think like the when you see like the stacks of bills, I don't think they've been kind of tumbled up and made to look like they're have just come from the street or anything
Gotcha.
just yet. But I really love the forfeiting like aspect of this movie. And I wanted more of it, because like the beginning of the movie where you see Defoe like mixing paint and like messing with machinery and everything, it's like so like process driven, it's like so tactile, it's like a sex scene, it's just so good.
It really is. It really is. And the first, like I want to say the first like third of this movie, the first act of this movie is so, for lack of a better term, vibey. It's just very much like about like the feeling of these scenes. It has a lot more of that like Wang Chung score, and then I feel like it gets more dialogue heavy. Do you feel like you have like a preference between the two, or do you feel like you like the way it unfolds?
No, I think it definitely gets a little bit weaker as it goes on, but it kind of like catches itself, and the movie couldn't sustain that first act for a whole movie.
Why don't you think it could have sustained that? Is it just like too much of like a lack of plot?
Yeah, you need something to be like the engine and to move everything forward, and to give us like enough of a buildup where like at the end, like we're left feeling like a hollow shell because of just like how the film ends.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. I liked the middle. I think I got a little lost in the plot in the middle, and then it sort of caught me again, like after the car chase, and then from then on, I was like absolutely hooked back in it.
Yeah, it has this, I think it relies really heavily on the Wang Chung score to kind of bring energy and excitement into the film. And I think it's like the soundtrack is my favorite part of the movie, but I think Friedkin kind of misplays his hand here, just because he is almost using like a fragment here, a fragment there, a little bit here, a little bit there, and he'll use the same bits over and over again. But he kind of won't sit with like a piece of a song for long enough for it to kind of really hit in. He's always just bouncing between things.
Oh, you wish he leaned a little harder into it?
This is my favorite soundtrack for a movie that is done specifically for the movie.
Really? That's high
Yeah.
praise.
I have this have this on vinyl, and this is the only
Really?
record that I have two of the same copy of.
No, that's awesome. I love the soundtrack to this. And I was surprised when I looked it up that Wang Chung didn't do any other scores. I could have totally
Yeah.
seen them doing like a Trent Reznor thing and just kind of pivoting to doing like soundtracks.
Totally, because especially if you are so essentially the whole album that the soundtrack is on, the first four or five songs, the A side of the album, is like all the ones that are just proper songs, and they play great in the movie. They play great on their own, and the second half is just like it's pure score. And so I think they showcase like something that's so unique, where it just provides this extra like some of the songs that are almost like kind of stings that Friedkin plays over and over in the movie, and just kind of slowly builds, and then just like get shot out of a cannon. You're like, all right, let's go. You're in a car going 100 miles an hour. You're high on cocaine. You're just going.
Hell yeah. No, totally, totally. And there's something so 80s about like opening a movie with a song that's the title of the movie. I
It's
just love
so
that.
good.
It's so good. It's so good. Are there any like 2023 movies that you wish had a opening song by a famous artist, and who would you commission to do that? Or 2022, I don't know, recent movies, say.
Okay, that's a tough one. So I think a good movie that came out last year that could have done a good score or a good like song for the movie, like commission for the movie. I would have loved to hear at the beginning of Nope by Kendrick Lamar.
Oh, that would have been good. That would have been
Yeah.
really good. Honestly, yeah, like all the Jordan Peele movies could have been really interesting in some ways. They're all like one or two syllables too, so that makes it interesting too. There's a lot you could do with
And
that.
I feel like Kendrick has like the humor to play with something like that too.
Yeah. No, true. That would be really good. That would be really good. The one I just thought of was I would love to hear like Destroyer of Worlds for the opening of Oppenheimer,
Oh yeah.
by. Should we do like Pearl Jam, Destroyer of Worlds? Should we
I could
commission
see that,
Pearl Jam
yeah.
for this?
That's a little kind of Michael Manny.
Yeah, it is a little Michael Manny. Yeah, not really Nolan. Nolan doesn't like lean into pop music except when he like casts Harry Styles in his movies. Anyway, yeah, no, I miss that. I mean, the only one that I can really think of in the last few years is Top Gun
There's
Maverick.
Barbie.
Oh, that too. But I mean, like Top Gun Maverick like leaned intentionally into that just because it was trying to bring back the 80s nostalgia, but Barbie does in some ways it doesn't have that like opening credits theme, but it does have quite a few like pop songs throughout and like has a,
Yeah.
comprehensive pop soundtrack.
Although I could totally see Lizzo's song getting down into Live and
Yeah, that'd be good. That'd be good. There's like a lot of artists that you could have for like a like an LA soundtrack, obviously, but yeah, no, that would work very well. Why, like, what about the soundtrack works so well for you? Because for me, it's so like driving throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, it really pushes you forward, like in the same way that I think one of the most effective things in movies is watching someone run, especially the way it's shot and the way that it kind of gets you there and puts you right alongside the character. And I think the equivalent in music is like just like a kick drum that kind of takes you along with it. And this the soundtrack is it's all kick drum.
Totally. I was thinking about Tom Cruise when they were running through the airport and
Yeah.
the latest Mission Impossible, and they just kind of keep running. And what's the lead actor's name again?
William Peterson.
Yeah, Peterson. He just leaps I texted you when he leaped over those airport chairs, and I was like, wow, that guy's very like athletic and
He's like prime Colin
graceful.
Kaepernick. He's just like
Yeah.
sprinting through that. He's like stiff arming people.
Totally, totally. And then when he like leaps up onto the people mover and like runs in between, it's so beautiful.
Yeah,
I wish we
he's
got
so
more like,
fluid.
yeah, totally. It's like pre-parkour, but like kind of like almost the basis of parkour.
And I think it plays so well into his character too, because a lot of the stuff he's doing is like not like needed whatsoever. It's just like his own little flair, and he's just like this adrenaline junkie that he's gonna, instead of like walking around the chairs, jump over them, or he's gonna be extra just because he wants that little bit of thrill while he's already chasing a criminal shooting at him.
Totally, totally. And I feel like that base jumping scene early on like really gives a lot of context to like the rest of his character in this movie, and that he's just like really an adrenaline junkie. Like he's always seeking these thrills, and he's always like that's his primary motive in a lot of these cases. It's not necessarily like I mean, you saw him at the end of the car chase where he's like all hyped at the end of this, and then his partner's just like distraught and
Having a panic attack.
having a panic attack, and he's amped up on it. It's fascinating the way he's always like seeking these thrills in a way that he probably shouldn't be, in a way that's probably not good on the police force.
No, like he's an adrenaline junkie with a death wish. Like
Yeah.
at the beginning of the movie, his partner who gets killed at the very beginning is like a How many times have you gotten me into like hot water? It's like I'm surprised I made it to the day before my retirement with you as my partner.
Yeah, totally. Totally. How did you feel about like his character and the way he was portrayed? I know you said like he's kind of a two film wonder in some ways, this guy, Peterson.
I think what he does so well is that there's like no drugs in this movie, but he is so clearly on coke the whole movie.
I didn't
Yeah,
think about that, yeah.
he's just always like kind of hopped up, kind of a little nervous, just ready to go. And like, I don't know, it's like the cliche cop. He's playing by his own rule book.
I'm honestly surprised there aren't drugs in this movie with all like the illicit activity and the nudity and everything else. There really aren't any drugs in this movie.
No, I think it's just all implied. You only see William Peterson's character like going, going, and going, and you kind of get the impression that if he kind of stops for a moment, he's just gonna fall apart at the seams. Like he's just doing the only thing that can kind of keep him going.
Yeah. How did you feel about his relationship with that blonde woman who I'm forgetting? I'm so bad with character names. What's her name?
Well, the thing about this movie is that, like, I don't remember any of the characters' names. The characters' names
Okay.
don't matter except Rick Masters, the Willem Dafoe
Yeah,
character.
Masters, I know. That one I know.
But I think she's just as disposable as everyone else. Like
Right.
he's so clearly just using her for both sex and information, and I'm not sure which is more important to him.
Totally. And it's sort of sad but weird the way his partner turns to her in the end for the same kind of relationship that he had with her. Is that sort of the implication there?
Yeah, it's he's turning into William Peterson at the end. It's like this cyclical nature of this guy getting his partner killed and then kind of going in, and now he's this hot shot kind of adrenaline junkie, like thrill seeker cop who doesn't play by the rules. And I guess I don't think they're even cops because they work for the Secret Service. I don't know what you call a
I
Secret
was
Service agent, but.
so confused by that because they're Secret Service agents. They're like clearly protecting someone. Is it implied that it's the president or is it just someone important in the opening scene?
I don't know if I'm making this up or not, but I think it's like a senator, like presidential
Okay.
candidate or something.
Got it. So they're protecting someone, but then it feels like the rest of the movie they're just kind of in the police force.
Well,
Or.
because the like counterfeiting falls under the jurisdiction of the Secret Service, like in real life.
Why is that?
I think it's just like from long, long ago, like at the advent of the Secret Service.
Weird. So counterfeiting
Yeah.
specifically is Secret Service over other crimes.
I'm like 87% sure.
Huh. That's really odd.
Yeah.
I'd love to look more into that
There's a
sometime.
Wikipedia deep dive after this recording.
Yeah, no, 100%. That's odd. But okay, so they're in the Secret Service. Robert Downey Sr. is the head of the Secret Service, I guess.
Well, at
And
least their boss.
yeah, their boss. And counterfeiting falls under that. Because I was confused why they're mixed up in counterfeiting when they're supposedly protecting a guy. How do you feel about like I think he completely mishandled the situation in which he's supposed to protect someone and then sees a suicide bomb. He's like a suicide bomber who's clearly just gonna like explode himself and is like, I'm gonna put the gun down. I don't really think that's good procedure.
I don't know if you kind of notice this, but he's not a very good like cop or whatever.
That's true. That's true. He's not very good at his job.
I
A lot of people
know.
get killed around him.
Yeah, he's always putting himself and other people in danger, and you rarely like see him like get the guy. Yeah, his original partner isn't avenged.
How do you feel like flames like play into this?
So at the beginning of the movie, like we're introduced to Willem Dafoe as he's burning his own art, and it's later brought up by the critic that like when he does he when he doesn't like a piece or if he just gets tired of a piece, he'll burn it. And at the end, Willem Dafoe dies in a flaming building filled with all his artwork and counterfeit bills and everything, just all up in flames. I think it just like represents this like disdain and lack of interest he has in preserving his art, whether it be his actual paintings, his counterfeits, or even his own life.
Why does he want to burn everything?
I could give you a like a an actual like an actual answer, or I can give you the answer that I think. I'll
I
give you
want
the answer
both.
that I So the answer that I think is he is just a cool motherfucker.
Yeah. Yeah, it is pretty
And
cool to like burn your own work.
I think the actual answer is that the burning of your work is art of itself too.
Yeah, I thought when he was burning his piece originally that he was gonna put out the fire at some point and have like a half burned thing, but then it just kind of kept going. I was like, okay, well, I guess it's just that thing's gone.
But is that not art? Like even if he's the only one who can experience that, is that not art?
That's true. It is art. It is art, but it's temporary. Have you ever seen like the Buddhist monks that like create like the sand art, like the like
No.
circular sand art? At school they had these like monks that came in and it's like this kind of kaleidoscope thing that comes out from the center, except the moment it's finished, it immediately gets wiped away because they take little files and they like do like colored sand and it's a big pattern like on a table. And then the moment it's finished, it gets wiped away to kind of like show like the transience of life, or like the idea that everything is temporary.
Huh. Well, if I ever see him, I'm gonna go up to him and yell at him for ripping off Rick Masters.
You should. You should.
Yeah,
You should. You should ask him which
I
came first. The yeah, I don't know what I was gonna say. Any thoughts?
I think just like the way the film ends, like from the moment they set up the deal with Willem Dafoe's character and they go in. And everything is going so well, and then just out of nowhere, Willem Peterson just gets shot in the fucking face, and his blood is just bright red, and it sprays all across the room. And suddenly, like in a just like a split second, like everything has shifted, and your main character is dead. It's fucking crazy, and it's such a bold choice, and it is so cool.
It felt very Psycho to me, even though, I mean, obviously Psycho happens like halfway through the movie, and this is like, you know, 15 minutes from the end or something, but it felt very Psycho. Like it's bold to kill your main character. I feel like it's almost at this point, it's bolder to kill your main character like 15 minutes from the end than it is halfway through the movie. Because like if you do it halfway through the movie, you have time to reestablish characters, but like you're just sort of relying on the audience to pick up the pieces of this character's death after that point.
I think the boldness comes from the fact that he dies without any foreshadowing or anything. It's something that just happens right then and there. And it's as surprise for the audience as everyone in the actual scene.
I was also surprised when his partner died like that early. It felt like they did a lot of like character work on the partner, the original partner, forgetting the name, but the guy with the stash.
I wanted to see him go fishing.
I know. I was excited for some action on the lake, but that never happened. They did a lot of character work on that, and that didn't seem to be foreshadowing that like he was about to die there either. I don't know how you felt about that.
I think like there is like I've said earlier, this movie is just playing with so many tropes that have been used over and over, and the dead partner trope, and they even say that he's one day away from retirement. So I think then just like some bells automatically go off where it's like, okay, I feel like I've seen this before. I wonder if they're going to do it or not. But I think especially in the manner he dies, it's just so like gross and grimy and just uncompromising, where it's like it's not even Willem Dafoe kills him. It's this big goon who kills him, shoots him with a shotgun, spits his spit out right there, shoots him again, and immediately spits. Just like so disgusted.
Yeah. No, he and like in a dumpster too. He sort of gets shot down on the back in the back of this warehouse.
I think one thing that we just need to, like, we talked about it a little bit, but the Robbie Mueller cinematography is just so good. Like, he's doing the 80s thing with just all these neon colors, but the way he just uses these, like, LA sunsets and this, like, smog and haze and, like, all these colors, there's, like, a haze to them, and it's just such, like, a distinct look.
Yeah, I feel like it captures it. It's a weird movie in that it, I mean, obviously LA plays such a strong part in like the title of the movie, but it's not really discussed in the movie. And like, I want to say other than the LA River, they don't really visit a lot of the landmarks, or anything that's distinctly LA other than, I mean, there were certain filming locations that I just recognize, like the rocks that are right by the warehouse where he gets shot are used in a lot of westerns because they're in the 30-mile zone. There's certain things like that, but and then like the Blade Runner train station, but it feels distinctly LA, and LA certainly plays a character without them ever really mentioning LA or having I want to say like a lot of the other tropes of LA movies, like the traffic or the urban sprawl, or I mean there's elements of that, but it's a lot of just like the feelings of LA that you're getting throughout.
I think one thing that's also kind of feels pretty LA is like there's kind of the high art scene that's kind of behind a lot of the Rick Masters stuff. And so it's like he's going to these houses to sell his counterfeit money. And there's just all this like beautiful modern art there. There's this juxtaposition between the Secret Service agents and like the quote unquote bad guys in the movie, where it's like the agents are like, they're the ones who are in the streets. They're the ones in the grime and the scum. And like Willem Dafoe's character, he's like in these nice houses. He is this like artist who could sell his work for tons and tons of money, and it's like this conundrum that's usually flipped on its head, where you expect the good guys to be the ones who are nicer and the bad guys to be the kind of scummy, grimy guys. But in this one, I think it just makes the interactions and the way these two worlds collide, it's so much more interesting this way.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot, as you were talking about that, it reminded me a lot of The Wolf of Wall Street, the way Kyle Chandler's character is buried mm-hmm. in all this paperwork and bureaucracy and stuff, and then he's like, and then he comes to the yacht to like chat with like DiCaprio, and like, but he's sort of like the weird FBI agent, like he's mm-hmm. not at all playing like the hotshot FBI agent, and that different kind of a situation, but a weird also kind of like reversed power dynamic. Is there a reason you think that Willem Dafoe's character Masters chooses to get into counterfeit money instead of just selling his art? Because, I mean, is it the same thrill-seeking behavior that Peterson's character is going after?
I would imagine it's thrill-seeking, because a lot of what he does is just like trying to move his shit. It's boring.
Yeah.
He's like negotiating with people, blah, 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 blah. I would just imagine, like, knowing what we know about his character, I would imagine he just views it as art. And the way that he's like physically making all these bills, and like, I'm presuming that every new batch, there are these different imperfections that he's having to mask and everything. And that there's a certain beauty to creating the perfect counterfeit bill.
That's true. I don't like dislike the way it ends. I just wish we got like a little more understanding of that, because yeah, he could, if he's in his high art scene, like that generates plenty of money if he just doesn't burn his inventory all the time. Seems like he has an arson problem more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to argue with that. He's just a pyromaniac. What can you say?
Totally pyromaniac. Anything else you want to mention? This one?
I feel like we didn't spend enough time on the car chase. Like, what a cool...
Oh, yeah. Car chase. Okay. This is another reason I feel like it's a sequel to The French Connection, which I'm demanding you watch very, very soon. The French Connection has like a great car chase in it, or gets it's like a car chasing the subway, which is also really cool. But the car chase is epic, and I love the scene where they're diving through all the like delivery trucks and like forklifts and just everything, and they're like dodging all these things, and then like the car pulls in front, they like pull out the gun on these guys. It felt like a fully fleshed out, like busy delivery, kind of an industrial zone.
It's so smart because it's not high octane really at all in terms of speed, but they tone it back and they just throw so many obstacles in there. It's like an 80s car, like car chase movie from an or car chase from an action movie meets like a Buster Keaton movie or something like that, where they're just constantly like the next thing and then the next thing and the next thing, like, oh, they burst through the boxes and they want to go through, and like, oh, I wonder what next is going to happen, and it's just always one more thing.
Totally. And it goes on for a while. I want to say it's like at least 10 minutes.
Yeah, because it starts out they're bursting out from underneath the bridge, and they're on the freeway and everything. And then they go under the other bridge, and they're going through the alleyways, ducking through everything. And then they burst out onto and then the river is next. Go down into the LA River, evade like all these people shooting at them. Like, one of my favorite shots is when they're going like directly through the water, just spraying everywhere. Oh, so good. And then they exit the river, and they kind of get pinned down and have to go on the freeway going the wrong way. And they're just like, cars are flying out of their way every which direction they're. It, what's so cool is that there's one part where they're going the wrong way on the off ramp. And instead of just sticking on one side, cars are going like left and right. So they're having to weave in and out of all these cars on this off ramp. And then it finally culminates and they're able to get away.
Totally, totally. I thought that was a really interesting take. Because theoretically, you could just kind of like hug the side and go like straight around all the other cars. But instead, it seemed like it was instigated by like the other drivers. They sort of had to dodge like all these other cars. I texted you because it looked like they were driving on the wrong side of the freeway.
Yeah, I want to watch it again because like I saw that text at the very end of the scene and I was looking at it and I'm like, wait a second.
Yeah, but it was bothering me at first because I was like, I was like, do I have like a bad copy of this movie or something? Because like I was wondering if like my whole screen was reversed, and then I remember like the opening titles were all straight and everything. So I was like, okay, I must not, but it looked like it was left-handed traffic.
Because I wonder if they literally just flipped like a negative like that to have the action composed how they wanted it, or if it's just like they obviously had to close down a whole highway for this, and it only made sense to do it this way logistically. But it's not something I would have ever noticed unless you brought it up.
Yeah, I don't know. I was very composed, as I was about to say. I have no idea. Definitely sort of perplexed me in the moment. Anything else you want to like mention about this movie? It's weird because it was sort of like on my radar as like something I should watch at some point, but it was just not top of my list. So I'm glad you recommended it. It was a very fun watch.
Yeah. I was looking up like, cause I'm like, thought the car chase was brilliant. I'm like, I wonder who did that. So I looked it up. It's a guy named Buddy Joe Hooker. And you know, which other car chase he did. He did Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof.
Oh, no way.
So much sense.
Wait, that's wild.
Yeah, because so Tarantino must have seen this movie and just like thought this car chase was just like incredible.
I could see Tarantino really liking this movie for a number of reasons.
It has this like perfect intersection of like style and genre that is very much Tarantino.
For sure, for sure. No, I could see that. Speaking of what I was saying about the bills not looking very good. To your point, apparently, despite the crew's best efforts, the bills made it into circulation, and the quality was really good. But the treasury seals that were used on letter X, not a valid. They made the reserve bills. Not valid, but they did make it into circulation apparently.
Because I did hear a story. There's been a lot of Friedkin stories going about recently because he died just about last week, and this is kind of the reason we're doing this episode.
Right.
I heard a story of him talking about passing those bills off like himself has been using them.
That's so crazy. Yeah. It was such a weird time on film sets. I feel like that shit would be shut down now.
Yeah, there's just something that a lot of those 70s directors had that made the film so good, but they were always a little bit off and always a little too eager to break the rules.
Totally. Having seen three of the less famous Friedkin movies, having seen like the exact opposite of Friedkin's stuff as I have, what about his style do you feel like is so distinct and works so well in this movie?
I think he's just like such a master of tone in a very specific masculine and athletic way, where his priorities are so much different than many than like less artistically minded directors, where he can just take a scene and inject this little bit of extra juice into it that makes it like just like a little bit more unique or a little bit more bold or a little bit more different. And that makes it so much more memorable, and it just hooks right into your brain.
Totally, totally. I personally, like, I really enjoyed the script of this movie, but I feel like the focus that the director put on like a lot of the themes, on like the motifs of like fire and this like thrill seeking kind of adrenaline junkie behavior and the neon lights and everything, like that's what added so much extra to the movie for me versus just straight up like the plot line on its own. I felt like the tone is what set it apart, because like I quite enjoyed a lot of the themes, but I feel like they were like seriously enhanced by his stylistic choices.
And even like the there's a few moments of dialogue where it's like, oh, this is just a little touch, like when the one guy at the train station opens up the letter for him and says "hello, asshole" on it.
I love that. I love that so much.
So good.
And then the scene where he's like reaching down his pants and looking for his package, I was just absolutely dead. I needed to text you immediately.
I love it when at first when Defoe gets the money, he tells William Peterson, he goes, "You're beautiful," and then Peterson does it back to him at the end. It's so cute.
It's very, very cute. No, totally. There's like a lot of little moments in the dialogue that stand out beyond what they normally would, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially just like with the little stings from the Wang Chung score and everything like that, it just like elevates it to a whole other level.
Totally.
I did. I was just digging the music so much that I was just watching the credits, like alone, like sitting on the couch with a pit in my stomach from the ending. And I did notice a couple things that I wanted to bring up.
Yes.
So do you know who the second unit of photography was credited with that on this movie? It's a familiar name.
Of course I know who. No, I'm just kidding. I do not know who the second unit of photography is.
Well, you're going to recognize the name. It's Robert Yeoman, who does Wes Anderson's movies.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so he apparently got his start here. Not necessarily a start, but he was working under Robert Mueller, that's a different guy.
Yeah, no, for sure. But that's interesting, because I'm trying to see the similarities. It's hard to see that when, you know, you're assuming that he's trying to emulate someone else's work, but yeah, no, that's really interesting.
And then the other kind of thing that I noticed was in the credits, there is this one guy who is credited as just Agent. And he has a name that I recognize, but I looked him up. He has only been in one movie. It's this movie. But his name is Rick Dalton.
I wonder if that's where Tarantino got the name. Honestly, I wouldn't be...
There's no way. He's been in one thing.
No, it's pretty unlikely. It's pretty unlikely. But that's pretty awesome. I do... Yeah. I do think that Death Proof is likely proof, for lack of a better word, that Tarantino loved this movie. Feels very up his alley, and I know he tends to pull from stuff that he likes. He tends to pull actors mm-hmm. and people on the crew from like stuff that he likes.
Because I know in his cinema speculation book, there's a chapter about the French Connection, I believe. I think there might be a little something about Sorcerer, too. I don't remember for sure.
Yeah, there is. I've not gotten there yet, but yes, I think there is a chapter on Sorcerer.
Yeah, so there's clearly some Friedkin love.
He's a Friedkin guy. Yeah. Yeah. I heard that he's trying to get Bruce Willis in his new movie.
Really?
Yeah, he's trying to get Bruce Willis like out of retirement for one final goodbye, which would, I don't really know where Bruce Willis is at health wise, but that would be, it would be epic if it could happen, but it might not be possible at this point.
You saw like the state that Bruce Dern was in when Tarantino cast him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. All he had to do was lay there in the bed.
True. True. If it's a role like that, it might be possible. Yeah. We'll see. No, that's awesome. No. Well, I appreciate you looking into the credits for me. digging really deep on this one. And I appreciate you recommending this movie. It was not on the top of my list, but it was a really fun watch.
Yeah, this is one that I love recommending to people. I'm sure there's going to be a little wave coming because it just got released on 4K. But yeah, man, this is one that people like have to see. I'm sure if people have made it this far, they have seen it. But
probably.
Yeah, it's definitely due for a little reevaluation, a little bump, especially now that people are kind of going back to watch some freaking stuff after he died.
For sure. R.I.P. Friedkin, very much missed. Also just like a big Hollywood history guy. Like he pops up on like a lot of those like Criterion extras and whatever. Like he's just a big preservationist and everything. So definitely will be missed.
Have you seen the interview he did with Nicholas Winding Refn at all?
No, I have not.
Yeah. Refn, like, you know, they're talking about like masterpieces and everything and like how they viewed their own work. And Refn mentions that like he thinks Only God Forgives is a masterpiece, and like Friedkin literally like laughs at him and goes like turns around and goes, "Does somebody want to get a doctor?"
Oh my God.
And he's like, "If you think that's a masterpiece, what do you think Citizen Kane is?"
Oh my God!
Like right to his face.
Oh man! Oh, that's brutal. That's really brutal. Honest to a fault. I love that. I do feel like I actually now that I'm thinking about this, a lot in common with Drive. Not necessarily main character wise, because in some ways Ryan Gosling is kind of the opposite of like a coked up cop, but vibey, like LA neon wise, like a lot in common.
But so imagine they look a little similar, but imagine instead in 1985, instead of making Lost in America, what if Albert Brooks starred in this instead?
That would have been really fun. I wish he did more serious work, honestly.
Yeah.
I really liked him in Drive, and I wish he would do more serious shit, even though he's like absolutely hilarious.
Yeah.
No, that would have been really fun. Anyway. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Do you have a quote? I know we're talking a little bit about this. Do you have a quote to wrap this up?
I think I can do a quote.
Okay, I have no idea. You gonna do the long one?
I'm not gonna do all of it.
Do all of it. Okay.
Yeah.
Do as much of it as you want. Go ahead. The mic is yours.
I'm gonna need you to lead me in though. I need you to ask me what's your name.
What's your name?
Fuck you, that's my name. You know why, mister? Because you drove a Hyundai to get here. I drove an $80,000 BMW. That's my name. And your name is? You're wanting. You can't play a man's game. You can't close them. And you go home and tell your wife your troubles. Because that's the only thing that counts in this life. Get him to sign on this line. Witches died. You hear me, you fucking... I'm not supposed to say the next word. Slur.
Yeah, skip that one. That was good. That was really good. Glengarry Glen Ross?
Yeah, that's remind me never to go into sales or anything like that.
I know I'd be very good at it. I almost went into sales. I think I could do it, but I don't think I'd be very happy.
Yeah.
That movie,
you don't have brass balls.
probably something to do with it, yeah. No, that's hilarious. Griffin, thanks for coming on. I'm sure we'll do another one soon.
Yeah, sounds great, man.